He had asked questions of none of the patients. His diagnosis was instant, the minute the patient came up to him. He either wrote out the prescription or took hold of the knife. Again, there was no pain, no bleeding, no sterile precautions. Most puzzling to many was that he often spoke in a German accent. Arrigo continued letting the sick in, day after day. His household turned into total chaos. He continued to have little or no memory of what took place. An amnesic veil descended on him from the time he met the first patient until the last was gone. But out of the chaos came two very 74, clear results. His hallucinations and headaches stopped, and patient after patient reported complete cures, including some that had an unqualified medical prognosis of death. It was obvious that this could not keep up. Arlit was thrown into total confusion. The church had now hardened in its posture. Arrigo must stop this, or find himself unwelcome in their faith. The command stopped just short of the threat of excommunication. Arrigo, his headaches and hallucinations gone, toughened in his own way. He still accepted the church wholeheartedly. He was faithful to it. He went to Mass regularly and received Holy Communion. He did not want to give up the church, but he felt that he was inexorably compelled to continue his healing work. He was needed. Why else did the people jam the streets in front of his house from daybreak on? He was soon visited by a man named Orlandino Ferrer, who was the nominal leader of the Cardesist group in Congonhas do Campo. By now there was no question in this gentleman at EMS mind that the previous communication with Dr. Fritz, through their own medium, was valid. He talked soberly and at great length to Arrigo, explaining what was happening in terms of the Kardec philosophy. Ferrer told Arrigo that according to Cardesist belief, the spirit of Dr. Adolfo Fritz was a incorporated a TM in him, a case of benign possession, as opposed to the black magic practice of conjuring up evil spirits. When Dr. Fritz entered into Arrigo, he literally took him over, supplying any diagnostic or surgical knowledge necessary for the case at hand. In other words, it was not Arrigo at EMS fingers or hands doing the operations, nor was it Arrigo at EMS mind prescribing the complicated pharmaceuticals which Arrigo consciously knew little or nothing about. But there was more involved than Dr. Fritz, Ferrer went on to say. There was a complete spirit band that worked together in this cause, which he would explain later. He wanted Arrigo to know some of this background so that he would have more peace of mind to carry out his important work. And Ferrer assured Arrigo that by accepting this Cardesist phenomenon that had arrived in such an 75, unwelcome way, he would have no need of forswearing the Catholic Church. Further, his faith in Christ would be more profound than ever. He knew the terrible conflicts that must be going on in Arrigo at EMS mind, and assured him they would be eased rather than aggravated if he followed his new calling. There certainly would be no conflict in basic belief, Ferrer continued. Kardec taught that science and religion were not even remotely in conflict with each other. Science merely was revealing the laws of nature, and in doing so was glorifying God. But science had much more to learn, especially in the areas of the paranormal, which had not even been scratched yet. The Kardec spiritists believed that the spirit world is simply less condensed than the material world, the world known to science. But it is the primary world of reality, and the material world is subservient to it. Thoughts and emotions create very real and traceable electrical energy patterns in the physical body, as a polygraph or an egg will easily record. So much more so does the human will, or the soul, according to the Cardesists. The biggest job of science is to explore this relationship between the spirit sphere and the material world, he added. Arrigo was in no position to absorb this type of philosophy at the moment. But it opened his mind to new vistas and encouraged him to go on with his healing work. He was persuaded by Ferrer to recognize the possibility that he was a medium, and as such, a channel to this strange new world he was not only learning about, but experiencing. Arrigo also recognized that he was now in the position of an acrobat split between two tightropes at the church on one side and Kardec spiritism on the other. It was not a comfortable position, yet he was unable to fall either way. The continuing complication was that he was usually unable to remember anything he did after he felt the strange tingling sensation that marked the takeover, or a incorporation at TM, by Dr. Fritz. And there were the mundane problems that were plaguing him. In addition to the condemnation of his behavior by the church establishment, his family life was 76, suffering acutely. His restaurant was faltering now, on the edge of bankruptcy. And in the distance were ominous rumbles signaling that the Brazilian Medical Association, along with the Catholic Church, was preparing legal action through the police of the state of Minas Gerais, Division of Robbery and Falsification. 77. 4. The stress on Arrigo was not eased by Senator Bittencourt. The senator continued to relate his miraculous surgical experience with Arrigo wherever he spoke, and the more the senator talked, the more the Brazilian press picked up the story and repeated it. As a result, people began coming from great distances to line up early in the morning outside Arrigo TM's little house. The crowds became more cosmopolitan. They were no longer confined to the poor and busy Ching. The tailored suits that marked the prosperous businessman, the chic lines of a Dior dress, mingled occasionally with the dusty work clothes of the farmer or miner. Cars with out-of-state license plates began to appear in profusion. Arrigo worked with his patients indefatigably, continuing to mutter German words, a language he never knew or studied, issuing loud and blustery commands, seizing a knife and lunging at the passive patients, who, for reasons unknown, never flinched or resisted. The local pharmacist found himself hard put to stock up on many strange new drugs he had never heard of before. A heavy preponderance of the drugs, he discovered from the detail men, were of German origin. Some were so new that they had barely arrived in the pharmaceutical warehouses of Rio or São Paulo. Others were old and had no TMT been generally prescribed in years. All, however, were part of the modern pharmacopoeia. Arrigo TM's hands wrote the prescriptions in a matter of seconds. His pen moving so fast that the prescription was ready almost before the patient could reach for it. Tourists who came to see the statues of Aligeidino often stayed on to see Arrigo about a chronic ailment. They returned to their homes with glowing stories about what they had seen and experienced. Some felt there was a metaphysical connection between the miraculous statuary of the little crippled leper centuries before and the miraculous cures that Arrigo seemed to be perpetrating. The Spiritists in 78 town had already accepted this theory. In spite of the growing reverence he inspired, Arrigo was no saint and never pretended to be. He stoutly maintained that it was not he who was curing, it was the teamwork of Dr. Fritz and Jesus. He denounced Halo Spiritism TM, carefully avoiding, however, any condemnation of the Kardec intellectuals, who were now creating a heavy influence on his outlook. He would announce at the beginning of each session that no one would be allowed to pay anything, not even the smallest gift. A Jesus never charged for what he did at TM, he would tell the gathering. And neither will I. But I am a sinner like you at TM. Though her household was now a shambles, Arlette continued to be mutely patient, torn and puzzled by this inexorable tide that had gathered. At the end of the long day and evening, there would be vomit and some a very little a blood to clean up, and Arrigo might inexplicably vomit himself, as if he had absorbed some of the ills of his patients, his eyes watering and clear fluid uncontrollably flooding from his mouth. The sheer foot traffic problem became onerous. Arrigo had no one to help him. Arlette had all she could do to handle the growing family and the sewing she took in to buttress their diminishing income. Ferrer, watching the incredible tide that was growing each day, talked with Arrigo about establishing a Spiritist center where the burden would be eased from his family. Plans were made to shift the clinic to the empty church across the street from Arrigo TM's house, no longer in use, and better adapted to handling the crowds. It was during this time that a gentle, soft-spoken man in his late 40s named José Tilda Copyright Nilo de Oliveira began having trouble with his left eye. Better known as Altimiro the Black, Because of his dark skin, he worked as a compositor for the publications of the Catholic Church, having retired from a clerical job with the State Welfare and Pension Office. Since his livelihood depended on his sight, his worry increased over the days. His doctor told him he had a cataract, and that it was inoperable at the time. He held out no hope for corrective surgery in the foreseeable future. 79. Altimiro, along with the entire village and country, in fact, had heard of Arrigo. He was aware of the growing hostility of the church against Arrigo, and dismissed the brash idea of visiting this living legend. He was also inclined to think that the reports coming out about the healer could not possibly be true. But when he learned that several priests and other officials of the church had quietly gone to Arrigo and reported cures where conventional medicine had failed, he mustered up his courage and stood in line. What he saw as he moved up toward the front of the line both frightened and fascinated him. The giant, bull-sized man was explosively speaking his guttural Portuguese, sprinkled with words that must have been German, ordering the line to move along, scolding some, putting his arm around others, alternately writing prescriptions and slicing his kitchen knife into a patient without any preamble. Altimiro found himself transfixed by the man, by his skill and sureness and confidence. By the time he reached the front of the line, his apprehension suddenly left him. Before he knew what was happening, Arrigo had pushed him almost roughly against the wall, asking him no questions. He reached for a knife on the small table in front of him. For some inexplicable reason, Altimiro felt no fear whatever. He mutely watched Arrigo Atiem's hand, the knife blade coming toward his eye. Then he felt a very slight pain, less than a pinprick. In seconds, he felt Arrigo press into his hand a tiny gelatinous piece of membrane. Then he heard Arrigo say, "Ego with Goda TM." Altimira moved off numbly, and by the next morning his eye could see clearly, without the thick lensed glasses used for cataract cases. When he sheepishly visited his doctor later for an examination, the doctor was at a total loss for an explanation. If the lens of an eye is removed, it is considered impossible for the eye to accommodate and focus properly. His defective eye now did so. Altimiro was content to let the question ride. His brief exposure to Arrigo made him determined that he wanted to work for this man, regardless of the circumstances. His resolve was buttressed when he took his uncle to Arrigo. The uncle was suffering from stomach cancer, and 80. His doctor held out no hope. But Altimiro watched in suspended disbelief as Arrigo took a large kitchen knife, plunged it into the viscera, reached in his hand, and pulled out a tumorous mass. When some bleeding began, he saw Arrigo lift his eyes toward the ceiling and say, "A Jesus does not want you to bleed at him." Miraculously, the bleeding stopped. Then Arrigo spoke again, "A Dr. Fritz, please close the wound at him." He then ran a piece of cotton over the gaping cut, wiping it lightly. The wound joined neatly, without stitches. Altimiro was almost in shock by the time it was over, but he told Arrigo that he wanted to work for him, without pay. Arrigo, as if the whole thing were preordained, accepted immediately and without comment. In spite of his twinges of conscience about the conflict between the church and Arrigo, Altimiro became an invaluable adjunct to Arrigo. It wasn't a TMT too long before he was able to type up the illegible scroll that Arrigo scribbled as prescriptions. In addition, Altimiro devised a system where he would issue numbered cards to the people standing in line, on a first-come, first-served basis. Arrigo had not yet brought the entire church thundering down on him. But it seemed to be only a question of time. A sympathetic pocket of priests, including Padre Pascal, were in charge of the church radio station that sat high on the hill next to the Church of Bom Jesus, under the shadows of the guardian statuary of Elia Jadano. They had become convinced through quiet investigation that Arrigo was achieving unheard-of results. Intense scientific study was needed, rather than censure, they felt. They were inclined to look at the phenomenon as parapsychology rather than spiritism. In this way, Arrigo would stand a better chance of being accepted by the church. In fact, a young aggressive priest, Bonaventure Kloppenburg, who had been vigorously attacking Spiritism throughout the country, had recently written, "The Catholic Church does not prohibit the study of parapsychology or the phenomenon of the medium. The Catholic is permitted to study either metaphysics or parapsychology. In fact, Catholic scientists in universities should study these fields at EM." It was this sort of loophole that Arago TMS friends in the 81 church establishment clung to, for they liked Arago and wanted him to stay with the church. But there were others of the hierarchy less charitable. They were already in contact with the Medical Society of Minas Gerais to see just how they might go about bringing down the law on Arago. In spite of what amounted to an open practice of illegal medicine, they would have to tread very carefully to push a trial. It would most certainly be held in Congonhas do Campo, and there was no telling what the citizenry would do if their folk hero were thus treated. Arago was widely popular, had been so even before his mystique and miracle cures had developed. He was known as a champion of the downtrodden and for his dedication to the cause of the miners. His sudden blooming into a healer now made him revered as well as popular. Brazilian authorities everywhere in the country were always forced to look the other way when it came to the primitive forms of spiritism in the Quimbanda and Umbanda traditions. There would not be enough prisons to hold all the followers of these ritualistic Afro-Brazilian religions. The Kardec spiritists were less conspicuous and more respected. Further, Arago had now attracted as patients some of the leading statesmen and political figures in Brazil. So far had his fame spread. For the time being, it was more prudent for the police to look the other way, but it could not be certain how long that would last. After finally having to sell his restaurant, Arago concentrated on real estate and the used car business to support his family. He also decided to campaign vigorously for the post of mayor of the town. No one quite understood where he got all the energy to add this burden to his already overloaded schedule. He continued, however, to place his healing work ahead of all other commitments. A portrait of Arago began to be pieced together from many points of view. Slowly, a tapestry emerged as his fame or notoriety, depending on the observer, spread across the country. The tapestry was as confused and variegated as a Picasso print, but there was truth rising out of the paradoxes. Arago was in fact many personalities, 82, involving grossly contradictory traits. Adding to the confusion were the subjective projections of those who shaped the portrait. Some related to his coarseness. Some saw him as saintly, and endowed him with this quality above all others. Some saw only his sensuality, because he was a sensual man, and many stories were spread about his real or supposed infidelities. Many would not believe he was so selfless that he refused money or gifts, although no real evidence was ever presented that would refute this. Before he started each daily session, he publicly declared that no one would be permitted to pay. He would not even accept a cup of coffee. He repeated this so often that any under-the-table dealings would have sprung into public currency like a brush fire, fanned by his enemies. The cross-section of observers who tried to dissect and analyze Arago was widely diversified. Aside from the blatantly curious, the people who gathered before his door each day were motivated by one essential problem: modern medical science had gone as far as it could go with them, and had given up. The problem might be minor and chronic, or major and lethal. Wasn't it worth the chance, they thought, to try something else, even if it seemed patently absurd? One point of view came from an intelligent, attractive press officer of the United States Information Agency in Belo Horizonte. She was a devout Brazilian Catholic, and therefore was ostensibly not supposed to have any faith in the Kardec healing philosophy. She had a 9-year-old boy who suffered painfully and persistently from acute asthma. The family doctor had prescribed allergy medications and injections, but these were almost totally ineffective. The attacks continued and worsened. As a last resort, she made a timid decision to take her boy to Arago. She arrived early in the morning, but there were already more than 100 people in line, mostly working people of modest means. She was impressed by watching Arago as she waited her turn, and, though rather frightened by his rude, blustering manner, she sensed a deep kindness underneath. His treatment of the boy followed what was now his 83, usual procedure. In a matter of seconds, Arrigoa TM's beefy hand had scrawled out a prescription. He said practically nothing, asked no questions. She was directed to take the paper to Altimiro, who quickly typed it out, and the session was over. She had an impulse to donate some money, but was sharply told this was not permitted. Later, she had many second thoughts about filling the prescription, but her desperation overcame her fear. With considerable trepidation, she took the prescription to the drugstore and had it filled. She followed the instructions carefully, worried about whether the medicines would do any harm. She was very pessimistic because the long courses of other drugs that her regular physician had been administering over several years had been next to useless. How could the prescription from the untutored Arrigo possibly be any better? She watched anxiously over several weeks, relieved to notice that at least there were no side effects or adverse reactions. But the weeks extended into months, and the frightening asthma attacks never came back again. As an intelligent woman and a Catholic, she was at a loss to explain the dramatic change. All she could say was that she no longer doubted Arrigo and was enormously grateful to him. But she remained puzzled and unenlightened about what had really taken place. Not long after Arrigoa TM's fame began radiating out of his little mining village, H.V. Walter, the British consul in Belo Horizonte, got wind of his prowess. Being a man of intense curiosity and erudition, Walter was fascinated by the stories that were filtering down from Congonhas do Campo. Not the least of these stories came from his close friend Carlos Paranhas da Costa Cruz, a dentist whose office was in the same building as the British consulate. Cruz, a graduate of the University of Brazil, appeared in the consulate office one day visibly shaken. Walter offered him a stiff pink gin and asked what the story was. Dr. Cruz told him that he had just returned from Congonhas do Campo with his father-in-law and sister-in-law, and did not yet know how to describe what had happened. 84, Sonia, his sister-in-law, and a woman of means and education, had been suffering acutely for 6 months from pains in her back. In addition, there was a suspicious lump growing in her midsection, and she was losing weight rapidly. The condition was diagnosed by her doctors, including her own father, who was a doctorate to be cancer of the liver. There was little hope, because the condition was considered inoperable. Out of desperation, Cruz went with her and her father to Arrigo. Arrigo asked no questions, and did not yet even examine the patient. He abruptly took Cruz and his father-in-law aside and told them that she had a tumor on the liver. She would have to be operated on immediately. Both were reluctant, but Arrigo insisted there was no other choice. Within minutes, Sonia was placed on newspapers on the floor of Arrigoa TM's small room. Arrigo brought some cotton and several instruments, including scissors and knives. He selected a penknife and made an incision. Both Cruz and his father-in-law knew that it was impossible to cut into the liver without massive hemorrhaging, and neither could explain why they permitted this to be done, or why they stood by passively as Arrigo cut into the patient with an unsterilized knife and no anesthesia. Perhaps, they thought later, it was because this was the last chance, all else had been given up. They watched for the blood to spurt out, but only a thin trickle slid from the sides of the wound. Then, Cruz claimed, an even stranger thing happened. Arrigo inserted the scissors deep into the wound, removed his hand, and the scissors seemed to move by themselves. Cruz turned to look at his father-in-law, who nodded and exchanged glances. Later, they were to compare notes and confirm, at least to themselves, what they had seen. In moments, Arrigo removed the scissors, reached into the wound, and pulled out a tumorous growth. With a showman-like flourish, he slapped the tumor into Cruz's TM's hand. Then he took the cotton and wiped it along the incision. When he was finished, the edges of the wound adhered together without stitches and Arrigo momentarily placed a crucifix on it. Then he told Sonia to rise, which she was able to do. She, 85, was weak and shaky, but felt no pain. The trio left Kangom as stunned and speechless. Cruz and his father-in-law, both being professional men, found themselves faced with believing what was unbelievable and accepting something that was scientifically impossible to accept. To them, the experience was more incredible than any in Lourdes, if only because this operation was real, tangible, verifiable, and yet it was a miracle. The British consul listened intently to Cruz's TMS story. He had been at his post in Brazil for over a decade and was prepared for almost anything. He followed the case with interest. Although the biopsy confirmed cancer, the liver regenerated itself and Sonia gained back all her lost weight and was completely restored to normal health. Carlos Cruz, determined to find just how such an event could happen, returned to Congonhas do Campo several times, taking H.V. Walter with him. Although he was a layman, the consul had a broad interest in medical science, and watched in astonishment as Arago went through his daily routine. Cruz, finding that his further observations of Arago confirmed the unbelievable capacity of the man, was forced to come to the conclusion that there simply was no scientific explanation for it. Even Arago's TMS use of the German language was startling enough. Cruz was hoping to gather enough data to persuade several different professional societies to make a special study, and perhaps even the Ministry of Health. It was obvious that the law could not permit Arago to continue his practice, and the authorities were certain to clamp down on him. This made good sense, but if some way could be found to bring Arago into a carefully controlled scientific study, medicine might be able to make some entirely new advances that would carry it into a new era. H.V. Walter was astounded and impressed with Arago's TMS work, but not at all impressed with the religious aura that Arago surrounded it with. The consul was a hardcore realist who frankly felt that all religion was poppycock, and was convinced that Arago's TMS piety was simply window dressing. Yet his world travels had taught him that primitive 86. Mana TMS instinct was often more sophisticated than modern Mana TMS. Carlos Cruz was not so sure, but he was not concerned about the religious aspect. The scientific study under legal conditions was to him the most important thing, and he was hoping to get this set up before the inevitable happened, when Arago would be clamped down on by the police. In spite of the threat hanging over Arago, the groundswell continued unabated. It was estimated that 1,000 Argentinians a month were arriving. In one instance, a chartered plane load flew into Belo Horizonte, the passengers taking a special bus from there to Congonhas do Campo. Bus transportation from Rio and São Paulo was scheduled round Arago's TMS workdays, with special sections added at times. The invasion of outsiders into the little town created a mixed blessing. The economy was of course booming, but the accommodations were inadequate, and many townsmen claimed that they were being exposed to diseases that might be contagious. On one occasion, Arago rose from his bed after midnight and drove to a remote clearing several kilometers out of town to meet by pre-arrangement a truckload of lepers. They had slipped out of their hospital and made the surreptitious pilgrimage to see him after learning about several former lepers who claimed to have been cured by Arago. Arago arrived in the pre-dawn darkness in his jeep to find them hiding behind the truck in the light of campfires and flickering candles. There were more than a score of them. They rushed to embrace him. He accepted their embraces without fear, and began treating them individually with an improvised day laying on of hands at EM method. Daylight was just beginning to suggest itself over the mountains when he had finished with the last leper. Arago hauled his heavy, bulky frame into the jeep and started back to the village. He wept openly all the way back. Only Altamiro knew of these clandestine excursions. If they came to light, the repercussions in the village would be overwhelming. The varieties of patients swarming into Congonhas do Campo continued to be a cross-section of the entire spectrum of society. An admiral arrived with his wife to see Katie 7, treatment for her cataracts. The operation was instant and verified, as Dr. Cruz and the British consul watched. The daughter of one of Brazil's TMS leading social families was brought to Arago in a wheelchair. Specialists in Rio had given up on her leg injury, the result of an equestrian accident. Arago yanked the leg forcefully. On her return to Rio, she was walking normally, and her cures confirmed by the same specialists who had given her up.